I'm Terry Gross, and on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with the hosts of All Things Considered. Noah Adams became the host of the weekend edition in 1978, started hosting the weekday edition in 1982. He left the program in 1988 to host Minnesota Public Radio's Good Evening and returned to All Things Considered in 1989. I spoke with Noah Adams in 1992 after the publication of his book, Noah Adams on All Things Considered, a Radio Journal. You write that at workshops, you always ask, how many of you are happy with the way you sound? Are you happy with the way you sound?
Oh, gosh, no. I don't think people outside the business really understand this. I have only worked with one person who really liked his voice, and he was in broadcasting for just a few years, and he was just enthralled by the way he sounded, and he was lost. He couldn't do much. This is the truth. I leave the studio here, and when I don't ride my bike home, if it's raining or something, I will take a cab after the program. And I will get into a taxi cab, and likely as not now, maybe a third of the time, All Things Considered will be on the radio. The cabbie's listening to our program on a later feed from one of the stations here in Washington. And I find, what am I going to do? I find it so painful to hear myself that I'll cover up my ears or ask him to turn it off and then have to explain the whole thing. So what I wind up doing is sort of whistling to myself. And at the same time, I'm proud of it. So a couple of times I have said, hey, that's me there on the radio. And they say, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's like, well, somebody's got to be on the radio. I just don't like the way I sound. I don't think most people do. And my attitude is, if they bring you a paycheck every Friday, then don't worry about it.
What reaction do you typically get from listeners who know you only through your voice and suddenly they see the body?
It's invariably disappointment, and I'm prepared for that. And I try to make them, because they're embarrassed, I then try to make them feel better about the fact that they are disappointed. And I try to make a joke. I'm 5'5", and they have whatever it is. I mean, I could look like Robert Redford, or let's say Brad Pitt, because he looks like the young Robert Redford in this new movie, A River Runs Through It. I could look like Brad Pitt, and they would be disappointed because people, I mean, the wonder, the metaphysical wonder of radio is that people have this idea of what you sound like, and you really shouldn't go out in public and dispel that, I think. I mean, I think it's better that, I think the magic happens on radio. And it's probably not a good idea to be running around out in the country too much, I think.
No, in your book, you're right. I've always had a difficult time starting a conversation with a stranger, and I can never quite understand how I ended up doing it for a living. What makes it easier to approach somebody with a microphone in your hand than to go up to them at, say, a party or on the street or whatever and talk?
Well, you have an excuse, so you have a reason for being there, and for me personally, it allows me to do it, and it's a very businesslike thing. And I also find that I'm focused a lot more, and so if I'm nervous, it doesn't really show, and it's not really a problem anymore. I used to go out to do interviews on stories, and really would pray that the person I was going to go see wasn't there, and I would be able to come back to the studio and say, "Well, the guy has stood me up; he wasn't there," and but it does seem to work out. I like to work with producers because they will go do that. They will, as I say, go up to people, and I'll talk to them. I hate to be so shy, but on the other hand, I feel that it does focus me, and I do pay more attention, and it probably does work okay, and people shouldn't worry about the fact that they're shy if they want to work in radio. Sometimes it gets really to be a problem, and I used to worry about it a lot more than I do now, and now I'm getting better, and I can walk right up to somebody and say, you know, I'm doing a radio story. Would you mind talking to me?
When was it a problem?
At the very beginning.
So what went wrong when it was a problem?
Well, I would just sort of stammer and stutter, and I wouldn't have the courage of my convictions. I recall talking to, and I still have that problem sometimes with interviews. I'll just tell you a quick story. I recall talking to Dr. Edward Teller some years ago doing a story about Star Wars, and we'd traveled. It was a long story. We'd done a lot of traveling. I'd read about 10, 13 books. I knew exactly what I was talking about. He was the last interview, and we went to his office at Stanford, and I let Dr. Teller totally intimidate me. I just let him run completely over me, mostly because he was a key figure in this thing. He recommended it to the Reagan administration the Strategic Defense Initiative. And his opinion was very, very valuable. I think he's a fascinating guy. Well, he was very mean to me. He said to me, for example, what is the long... I wish I could do his accent, but I won't insult him by trying to do it. What is the longest... This is a very sophisticated question. What is the longest unedited answer you will use on the radio? And I said, oh, I don't know, 40 seconds. And he said, fine, ask me a question. I asked him a question. He said, no, that's a stupid question. Ask me this question. That's a stupid question. Ask me this. How was it that you thought to suggest this idea to President Reagan in the White House in the Oval Office? Anyway, like that. And he said, fine. And he had his own stopwatch on his wrist, and he started his answer and started the watch and finished at 39 seconds and said, see there, now you owe me 1 second. He said, you will not edit that answer. And I felt bad over the years that I didn't tell him exactly what I thought of that situation, hoping, and not just to be vindictive, but hoping to provoke him into a real conversation about the issue. As it turned out, we had hardly anything. We just had to put what he said right on the air, and it really wasn't a good dialogue.
It's amazing when people think they're really doing themselves a service by thinking they're outsmarting you when really they're sabotaging themselves.
Yeah, well, he may have been hurt badly, misquoted in the past.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was.
My guest is Noah Adams. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Noah Adams, a host of All Things Considered. I asked him if he had any ground rules for interviewing and if he tells the person he's interviewing what to expect.
No, I don't think so. I always will tell them that we are recording the interview at the moment we start, and that can be a bit disarming because you can be having a nice conversation on the satellite circuit or a telephone circuit or even here in the studio. And they're just talking to you, and they're having a great deal of fun. And then if you say, okay, now we're going to start to record, they say, oh, okay, well, ask me a question, and I'll give you an answer. I sort of tighten up. But no, I don't. I sort of have some rules of my own, but I don't tell people about that. I'm thinking.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'm thinking about, I don't pry very much. I want people to answer the question, to be honest, about answering the question, to give me a direct answer. And to that end, I'm going to do almost anything I have to do. I recall asking somebody who was a Klan leader one time why they hated black people. And it was an astounding question to this man. He was sitting in our studio with two bodyguards. And I was determined I was going to get some sort of answer to that, or at least 2 minutes of his trying to answer it that would be pretty evident.
Was he able to explain to you why he hated black people?
No, he had never been asked that question before. It was the conceit that's not what was on his mind, or that's not what drives him in the organization, and he was shocked by the question. He really was.
Oh, but by the assumption that he hated black
right,
people,
right? Yeah.
Well, that must have really thrown you, though. I mean, how do you get? Then you have to kind of get beyond the surface of what somebody tells you they're about and try to get beneath to what you suspect they really are about, and they're going to fight you on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it happens. I think that all interviews should be basically adversarial in nature, which is to say that I think that if somebody has one strong side of a position, that the interview should come from the other side. Tomorrow you may do one totally on the other side of another issue, but I think that all interviews should just be a little bit tense. And I'm probably not, you know, I could name 10 better interviewers in public radio than I am. I'm a bit too romantic. You know, I think everybody's great. I have to remind myself to be cynical. I wish I'd gone to law school. I think law school would be great training for journalism because, you tend to look at both sides and to try to figure out if somebody's telling the truth.
So you believe that the interview should be adversarial, but on the other hand, you admire a lot of the people you interview and you don't do the adversarial interview.
Yeah, well, sure. I've just come back. I know I've come back, especially with old men. I will just go out and make a fool out of myself with old men and old women. And I would just, make saints of them on the radio if editors would let me do that. And the editor will say to me, well, why didn't you ask this or this? And it just never occurs to me sometime because I like them so much. You know, old people who have accomplished something. And I'll go talk to them and I just think it's great what they're doing. And there'll be these shadowy aspects of their past that I never get into. So I have to watch that.
Are you ever alarmed by what you find out about a person after the interview? I mean, it's happened to me that I've interviewed somebody who struck me as a very sensitive poet. Then a week later, I talk to someone who happens to have been their student. They say, oh, by the way, do you know that he slept with a lot of his students? And it's like, no, that wasn't in our interview. I did not know that.
Yeah.
And you feel like, well, you've given this really sensitive portrayal of somebody, and it's false.
That's what I meant by being overly romantic. That happens to me quite a bit. In fact, I had this happen. I guess we've all been fooled now. I don't know about you, but many of us here at NPR have been fooled by interviews. There was a story a few years back about a florist down in Charleston, West Virginia, who had been persecuted in his community because it was known he had AIDS. I called this man and did the interview, and, oh, it was heartbreaking. He told about going into the supermarket and having people turn the other way with their carts and run away, and having a woman drive up to his flower shop and throw a check. She owed him money, through the front door. They shunned him in this community. It was just a wrenching interview. It turned out to be a complete hoax. I don't know what was going on with this fella.
How'd you find out?
Well, we had checked it out a bit, and the state attorney general in West Virginia had made a statement, so we put the story on the air. And then 2 weeks later, or three, the state attorney general said, well, this man's telling a lie, and we've all been fooled. And I've always felt so bad about that, because we didn't make one phone call, not one, into this man's community down there near Charleston to say, do you know this guy? Is he telling the truth? Is the community shunning him? We didn't. And we got a letter, and it said, you have insulted everybody in the state of West Virginia. And I think that the letter writer was right. You know, I think we made a terrible mistake like that.
Now, in your book, you say, and I really agree with you on this, that you find it more difficult to interview people who you know, and you prefer to interview people that you don't know. Can you explain that phenomenon? Because I usually experience the same thing.
I don't know what that's about. I don't know how that works. Maybe it is that I'm just a bit too much relaxed, and maybe the things we're talking about are too well known between the two of us. I've gotten to know people who I've interviewed before and tried to interview them the second time, a second book, for example. And I find it to be difficult. And a lot of times it hasn't worked. And a lot of times I will just say, well, you know, let's go on and find somebody else. Let's find the first novel from somebody else or a new book of poetry. You don't have to interview. Over the period of time that I've been here, I've talked to John McPhee three times. And, you know, now I still love his writing, but now I'm trying to find somebody who would have been like John McPhee was in 1975. I don't want to say like a young John McPhee, but you know what I mean? I'm trying to find somebody at that level, because I'd rather just go have lunch with John McPhee and talk about what he's doing now than to try to do a radio interview with him.
You're out on assignment a lot. Say during the Gulf War they had said to you, Noah, we want to send you to the Middle East. We want to send you to Saudi Arabia. Would you have wanted to go?
Yeah. I wanted to go to the Persian Gulf War because, for one thing, it was a bit safer than some other places. I'll just tell you a quick story. I went to Romania right after the revolution, and John Hockenberry was dying to get there as soon as he could. In fact, got there very, very early. Came in on Monday, Christmas Day. That's the day that they executed the Ceausescus. And John called back to his editor here and said, tell those other guys to wait, it's not safe. I was one who was saying, you know, I've got a career and a reputation. I don't need to go in there. It's very dangerous. We thought that first weekend they were killing over 10,000 people. I was saying, let's wait, go in later. So I'm very cautious. I did want to go to the Persian Gulf War. These things pale, though, by comparison to what's going on in Yugoslavia. It could be 30 journalists who have been killed there. It's a desperate, desperate situation. I have so much admiration for people like John Burns of the New York Times, and for Blaine Harden of the Washington Post, Tom Jelton of NPR, who's been in Sarajevo. It's an incredibly serious and difficult thing they're doing, and I would not want to go to Sarajevo at this point.
You know, I just want to say, I for 1 week, I think it was, I guest hosted All Things Considered, and so we worked together that week. And I remember in the studio, I would have all these questions about what happens next and what do I do. And there's times when I thought, well, we'll just like sit and schmooze while this story is on. And you were so intently listening to the show. I mean, it was just really clear to me that, you know, you wanted to know absolutely everything that happened on the program, and you felt very responsible for everything that happened on the program, whether it was your piece or not your piece, but you felt that listeners would hold you accountable, and you were holding yourself accountable.
Well, you know, the big bad thing about coming to Washington to work for All Things Considered is that you don't get to hear it unless you go home and then listen to it or come back the next day. So I want to be at least on a par with the listeners. I want to know what was on the program. And a lot of it's really practical, too. A lot of things will come in context that you need to refer back to. So I try to hear as much as I can.
Noah Adams is a host of All Things Considered. His next book, to be published in March, will be about the year he spent learning to play the piano. Our interview was recorded in 1992. More interviews from the archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air.